Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Rob Moore. We're both doing breathing exercises and mouth exercises. We just want to be limber for today's program, which we're just going to be talking with one person today, but we're going to be talking about two different subjects. The first part of the program, we're going to be talking about soy. There's been a lot of confusion out there within the vegetarian and vegan communities, as well as beyond, about whether or not soy is really good for you. There's a whole bunch of different opinions, and we're going to be speaking with Joel Furman. And he's a medical doctor from New Jersey. He has a private practice there. He's a family physician, and he's going to give us his insight into soy and all of the confusing things. You might have heard some catchwords like phytoestrogens and phytates and enzyme inhibitors, and we're going to sort through all of that confusing mess and see if a steady diet of veggie dogs is the way to go. Or not. And then we're going to be hearing about his book, Eat to Live, which focuses on preventative medicine for chronic illnesses. So that's Dr. Joel Furman. But before we jump into the interview, we hear from Rob Moore doing the news.
Thank you, Lauren. In this week's news, PETA leaves me speechless and Greece is killing dogs while we're banning them. But sometimes it's not only news we report, but touching and sad stories like the following from the Globe and Mail. In the middle of Tina's gravesite in the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee, there sits an old, battered tire. After 2 days of standing by Tina's grave at the sanctuary, her best friend Sissy finally left, leaving behind her favorite tire as a tribute to her friend. In the middle of the gravesite, there's elephant prints all over it, and in the middle of it is Sissy's tire, said Carol Buckley, director of the elephant sanctuary. Sissy carried the tire around as her pacifier, as her security blanket, and her tire is now left on top of the grave. At 2:45 a.m. Wednesday, with her closest friends Sissy and Winky by her side, the 34-year-old Asian elephant died. There was no sign of stress or panic. Her eyes were calm, said Miss Buckley. She set her head down, and I was with her, and Scott was with her. It was probably a minute or a minute and a half, and she closed her eyes and she passed away. For Sissy and Winky, who lived with Tina in the barn, the death has been particularly difficult. They remained with her, touching her, caressing her. Winky was pushing her trunk a little bit, like, "Wake up, wake up!" Remembered as a princess of an elephant with a big heart, Tina was friendly to everyone she met. After living in Vancouver for most of her life, Tina had been transported from the Greater Vancouver Zoo to Hohenwald in Tennessee last August to get help with a foot infection. Miss Buckley said staff were surprised by the sudden death, since Tina appeared to be recovering well from her foot ailments. The sanctuary is still trying to determine the cause of her death. So I'd like to send our sincere condolences out to the staffs of the sanctuary and the Greater Vancouver Zoo, and of course, to Sissy and Winky. But on to lighter news. The Taste of the Danforth in Toronto is right around the corner, August 6th to 8th. And Laura at the Organic Buddha wanted to give everyone a heads up, as they'll be out serving up great veggie goods. Laura says, "We are looking for volunteers to help us make this year's Taste of the Danforth the most veggie-friendly yet. Over 1.2 million people will be passing through, looking for delectable samples of cuisine. ARC2 will be joining us to promote vegetarians, health, and animal rights, and we welcome other groups to use this platform as a way to reach out to as many people as possible. To volunteer, please email us at theorganicbuddha@hotmail.com or call 416-406-3338 and leave a message. Now from the Mercury News, two men were charged with promoting dog fighting by publishing a 10,000 circulation underground magazine that decreed pit bull champions in the illegal competitions. The charges of cruelty to animals and conspiracy to commit cruelty to animals in Pennsylvania carry penalties of up to $15,000 and 7 years in prison. The bi-monthly magazine contained information on clandestine dog fights, their results, and advertisements for puppies, stud services, and equipment, such as treadmills and brake sticks used to separate fighting dogs. And more on pit bulls from today's Windsor Star. 4 days after a 4-year-old Windsor boy became the latest victim in a string of dog attacks, City Council approved the first and second reading of a new bylaw banning specific breeds of dogs and referred the issue to the Licensing Commission, which will hold a public meeting August 17th. The bylaw, which is modeled after one adopted by the city of Kitchener, would ban pit bull terriers, Staffordshire bull terriers, American Staffordshire terriers, American pit bulls, and any dogs which have the appearance and physical characteristics predominantly conforming to the standards for such breeds. But opponents of the breed-specific ban claim that it unfairly targets responsible dog owners, and that the onus for control of such dogs lies with the owner. Opponents say, encouraging responsible ownership, education of children, implementing bylaws that punish those who are not responsible, the owners, and giving law enforcement the ability to apply the laws has proven to be efficient and effective. In a related story from thefacts.com out of Texas, a 5-year-old boy is home after spending Thursday night in a Houston hospital being treated for multiple dog bites by a golden retriever. In tomorrow's news, golden retrievers banned in Texas. And something from the Toronto Sun, did you like that?
That was good.
And something from the Toronto Sun, which is a surprise in itself. Some of Canada's Olympic athletes are outraged the Canadian Olympic Committee won't take a stand against Athens officials who are poisoning up to 15,000 stray dogs in the city so the country looks pristine during the games. It's horrible, but it has nothing to do with us. We have no official comment, said a COC spokesman. Since Athens officials are doing this for the Olympics, it has everything to do with the COC, said Olympic runner Leah Pels. We should all stand up, and there should be a huge outcry against this because we are sending athletes to the games. It's just appalling, said Linda Elmy of the Toronto Humane Society. Athens officials have said the city needs to be dog-free for the games for aesthetic reasons, said Diane Alden of Greek Animal Rescue Canada, which is working with international animal protection groups to stop the slaughter. And congrats to Andre 3000 and Alicia Silverstone, who were chosen this year in PETA's poll for the world's sexiest celebrities who don't eat meat. I guess I was out of the running.
Was that just a North American poll?
Yes.
All right. Because I would question that.
At least I think so.
Okay.
Don't quote me on that.
All right.
12,000 people voted.
Right.
And speaking of PETA, a headline that caught my attention was in the New York Times titled, At Last, a Company Takes PETA Seriously. It says PETA has fought a long legal battle with Kentucky Fried Chicken, trying to push it to give its chickens larger cages, stop forcing the birds to grow so fast that their legs collapse, and to gas them so they die painlessly before their throats are slit. Although I might add that being gassed is also proven to be a horrifying experience for animals. You may recall that PETA released videotapes from a hidden camera planted by a member who worked undercover in a West Virginia slaughterhouse for 8 months. Instead of recording the normal unpleasantries of factory farming, like chickens with their beaks burned off or unwanted male chicks ground up alive into fertilizer, it recorded workers stomping on live chickens and flinging dozens into a wall. The investigator said his co-workers tore the head off a chicken to write graffiti, strangled the chicken with a latex glove, squeezed birds till they exploded, and committed hundreds of other acts of cruelty. Yum! Brands, the parent company of the KFC Corporation, called the tape appalling, sent in inspectors, and told the plant owned by the Pilgrim's Pride Corporation to clean up its act or lose its contract. Pilgrim's Pride fired 11 workers and managers and said it would make everyone at its 25 plants sign promises to treat animals humanely. And while it's great that PETA revealed that footage, and I'm going to editorialize here for a minute, their main aim appears to be to simply make the killing better, but that effectively leaves me without ammunition. For example, if I'm having a conversation with someone about factory farming conditions, they invariably say, oh, they're treated humanely. To which I, of course, tell them the exact opposite and say, well, look at KFC's suppliers. PETA revealed all this atrocious treatment. But now they can say, yes, but because of that video, Pilgrim Farms changed all their procedures and fired people and hired others, so now it's okay, and they're treated humanely. PETA even says so. And then what am I supposed to say as they're diving into their third KFC chicken breast with a clear conscience? If I get into what is not on the video, like beak trimming, or the burning ammonia, or the filth, or the basic right for an animal to live his own natural life, I'll just be spouting rhetoric because it's already been proven to them that the organizations involved, plus PETA, plus the Humane Society, Society of the U.S., I might add, are satisfied that they can eat that chicken with a clear conscience. I'll just be theorizing that when we control animals in such a way that it fosters an environment of cruelty. But they'll say, no, PETA made sure it was okay to farm and eat them, so I'll just keep on eating them, thank you very much. Now, this is not to criticize PETA's undercover work, which I think is amazing, but I guess I'm feeling ambivalent about the desired results. But perhaps I've misconstrued their statements, as I know every AR organization wants the world to go vegan, or I would think so. But that doesn't seem to be what the public is hearing from them, at least from this kind of article.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I always think it's funny that PETA really gets to stand for the animal rights movement within the mainstream media. You know, when people are going to write a story about animal rights, they often write about PETA as if, like, that's the beginning and the end of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And they're invariably referred to as the animal rights extremists. And I think this is quite funny because a lot of the efforts that PETA has been doing would be categorized as welfarist.
Yes.
So the difference being, you know, the rightist approach is more in terms of abolition and trying to get rid of the cages, not to make the cages slightly bigger, which is more kind of a welfare move. So I think that what PETA is doing is great, and I think the undercover work is so incredibly important. But
yes,
I think
definitely.
That maybe the language could just change a bit and say, you know, the welfare measures, you know, we're trying to propose that they be, you know, improved. But I don't really know what the point of improvement is if there isn't enforcement, and that means on every step of the whole process for an animal who is raised for food. So that would be, you know, both in the incubation, the breeding, you know, all those different steps that you were talking about in terms of, like, the debeaking and everything. You know, and there's transportation issues. There's the getting on and off of trucks. There's the actual slaughter process. There's all those other things that have to happen in between. Like, there's, you know, just, like, there's hundreds of steps. And if those aren't being enforced all the way along, I kind of don't know what the point is, and I don't think they're going to put the money there. I don't think the industry will put the money there where the bottom line is profit. This is just a capitalist industry that's all about making money. So I think it's a great PR move for the industry to say that we've made things better. But I don't think that this is an animal rights action. I think it's an animal welfare action necessarily going to be enforced. So it's a concern.
And like I say, I'm kind of scared that I'm left without ammunition.
Right.
I can't say they're, I mean, I can say they're not treated humanely and go through all the 100 steps it takes them to be slaughtered. But they'll say, well, no, PETA looked at it and they've, you know, corrected these measures, so isn't that enough?
Mm-hmm. My feeling would be if somebody is still confronted with the information that you give them and they still continue to say that, they probably weren't ready to change anyway.
Perhaps.
Or look at their, you know, because unless they're just eating chicken and they're just eating it from KFC and they feel good about that, you know, it wouldn't say anything about the milk that they're drinking or the pigs that they're eating or anything like that. So,
And it's what we tell ourselves, too.
Sure. And I feel like I can understand that. I'm sure I told myself similar things.
Yeah, way back when.
Before.
Yeah, you know.
So that person probably just isn't ready
yet. I guess. But I do really want to say congratulations to PETA and, you know, props to the undercover worker who spent 8 months, 8 horrible months, I'm sure, at Pilgrim's Farm. So I think that's amazing work, and thanks for bringing all that to light.
Yeah, my concern too is, you know, looking at worker issues within factory farms and slaughterhouses, people often say to me, like, how can people do this to animals? And, you know, look at those workers, and it's so easy to blame the workers, and I don't want to sound like an apologist for that kind of terrible behavior, but at the same time, like, these industries are targeting the most disenfranchised people, the people that they don't think will unionize, and putting them in conditions that are, like, incredibly stressful and physically horrible, and often the workers refer to these types of places as soul-sucking dumps, and I don't think that that's an excuse for the abuse that happened, but I think it can give us some context for this industry, which is run by profit and greed, and the people that are making money from it primarily are not the workers themselves. So I just think that's an interesting point as well.
Well said.
So there we go, editorializing. We're gonna go. We're gonna have a short break, and then we're gonna come back on the line with Joel Furman, and we're gonna hear all about soy. If you've been confused about soy lately, as I have been, we will help you wade through some of the issues so you can make maybe a more informed choice. I'm looking forward to making a more informed choice about soy. And we're also going to be talking with Joel Furman. This is a medical doctor from New Jersey. We're going to be talking with him about his new book, Eat to Live. So please stay tuned to Animal Voices. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto radio station, community radio station. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with co-hosts. I'm going to start calling you the co-host now, Rob Moore.
Cool.
And news guy. Today we're going to be speaking with Joel Furman. He's a doctor. He's a medical doctor, and he is a board-certified family physician in private practice in New Jersey. And I'll just read you a little bit about him from his website. This is from his bio. In contrast to traditional physicians and alternative medicine practitioners, Dr. Furman's progressive approach to medicine focuses on achieving superior health through excellent nutrition and thorough interventions to establish an optimal environment for healing. And the first part of the program, hopefully I wanted to talk about soy, and then we're going to be talking about Joel's new book, Eat to Live. So Joel, thanks for being on the program today.
Oh, great to be here.
So I wanted to start off by having a conversation about preventative medicine. And as an entry point into that, I wanted to talk about soy and then move into your recent book, if that's all right.
Sure, do it in any
order. All right. So there has been a lot of confusion about soy lately, and some of the tag words that I threw out there for people were, words like phytoestrogens and phytates and enzyme inhibitors. And I was wondering if you can give us your take on soy and clarify some of those terms for us.
Sure. Well, first of all, we have to put in proper context that obviously the question comes from because people are interested in their health. They want to have good health. They don't want to have a heart attack. They don't want to get cancer. They want to live longer. They want to age slower. They maintain their youthful mental faculties as they get older, right? We all want to stay in great health. We want to eat as healthy as possible. And if we want to eat as healthy as possible, we're looking for two or three things to do. And one is we need to get a diet that's nutrient-dense. We want to have a diet with lots of nutrients in it per calorie. We want to eat high-nutrient foods or healthy foods. And also, we want to get a variety of those nutrients. We can't just take a lot of vitamin E and a lot of vitamin A and a lot of vitamin C and take those high levels of three or four nutrients and expect to get well. We want to take high levels of thousands of nutrients, all the nature's full symphony, the symphony orchestra of nutrients. Now, if you place soy in that context, the answer is that beans are a very excellent food with lots of sterols, stanols, and anti-cancer compounds, as well as phytoestrogens and other phytochemical compounds that are important for excellent health. Beans are a wonderful food to complement a diet that includes lots of vegetables, lots of fruits, lots of nuts and seeds. In other words, we want to get a lot of variety of these healthy foods in our diet. Now, all foods have nutritive substance in them, and all foods have some toxic components, a component that isn't that good for us. And that's okay because the body is designed to remove certain degree of toxic waste and to process certain unhealthy compounds in food. We wouldn't want to eat a diet that, even though flax seeds are a great food, we won't want to eat a diet where we eat like half of our diet from flaxseed. We'd be getting some very compounds that aren't healthy to take in a large amount. We wouldn't want to eat a diet of all broccoli, as healthy as broccoli is. We don't want to just eat broccoli because you'll have too much of the, or too much Swiss chard. You might get too much oxalic acid or too much of the goitrogens from broccoli. In other words, all foods have some negative aspect, just like soy does. We don't want to eat a diet that's, 30 to 60% of calories come from soy. It will be very imbalanced. You get some of the things that aren't that great in soy in too high amounts. So to start the conversation going, soy is an excellent unprocessed soybean that we call edamame sometimes, mm-hmm. is an excellent food that's extremely healthy to use in our diet. But I encourage people to eat a variety of different types of beans, to eat split peas and lentils and red kidney beans and soybeans. If we took lentils, though, for example, and we started processing them and making lentil cheeses and lentil hot dogs and lentil fake turkey, and we add a lot of salt and artificial ingredients, then lentils wouldn't be that healthy for us either. Mm-hmm. In other words, people eat a lot of processed soy foods that don't resemble the original bean, and those aren't healthy foods to eat. If we ate a diet of nothing but corn, that wouldn't be too healthy for us either. But if corn and putting corn and sweet potato and string beans and broccoli and beans and soy and cashew nuts and sunflower seeds and you follow me, as a component of a healthy diet, it's certainly a healthy addition to an otherwise well-varied diet.
Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, we have edamame, so the, you know, the whole soybeans, and on the other hand, there's the, you know, highly processed soy products that are out there. You mentioned the soy cheeses, etc. But what about the in-between, you know, products like tofu? What about tofu? How is that for you? I mean, what I'm hearing is, you know, moderation is the key. You know, you want a variety. Is tofu a good selection then, you know, in terms of every once in a while?
Sure. Tofu, there's no problem with tofu. There are... You know, if we look at this, you know, there are lots of information on the Internet that's very biased in both directions. I mean, obviously, there are some people, a lot of research done on soy, by the way. And because it's a heavily researched food, there's not as much research done on red kidney beans or black-eyed peas or navy beans, for example. But if you did research on any of those beans, you'd find beans in general have the ability to lower cholesterol. They contain certain fibers, water-soluble and insoluble fibers, and they contain sterols and stanols, and they contain, you know, the beans in general have compounds that do lower cholesterol. Even the proteins in beans have an effect to drop cholesterol and are very beneficial to us. And soybeans have been shown to lower cholesterol, and so are other beans. But to answer your question, tofu is certainly a healthy food. It's linked in the medical literature to lower rates of breast cancer, not higher rates. And populations that eat tofu as part of their diet seem to have, generally speaking, long lives and low rates of cancer. I'm not saying it's a complete wonder food, but it does continue to contain some of those beneficial compounds that are present in the soybean we get in the tofu. There was one study done that showed that in Hawaii that people ate too much tofu had more Alzheimer's disease, but then the doctors tested the tofu made in Hawaii and found aluminum in the tofu processing plants.
Oh.
They thought it was the aluminum in the processing of the tofu, not the tofu itself. We didn't find the same findings when tofu consumption went up. We didn't find increase in any problem like that, only that one study. But then somebody on a website will magnify that or will take it out of context and make it seem like tofu is such a dangerous food that it causes dementia, which really is not true. So the other words, the moderate use of soy products, the use of soy products that are not heavily processed, like an unsweetened soy milk or a tofu as part of your diet mixed in with vegetables and other foods is okay to do. We just wouldn't want to eat that to the exclusion of eating, obviously, fruits and vegetables and other beans.
How do people sort through all the information, especially if, you know, they're using the Internet, they're sort of, you know, curious about the benefits and the negative effects of something like soy? When I was doing an initial search on some of the myths and facts around soy, you know, you'll have one medical doctor saying, it's terrible, and then you have another medical doctor saying, it's a wonder food. Do you have advice for people how to sort through the information out there? Ideas?
Well, I mean, that's what I do for a living, obviously, is I'm a doctor. I move most of my practice online, actually, at drfurman.com. You know, we have forums where people can ask me questions on the web, and I write, you know, newsletters, and I give out information on the website. But basically, what I do is I try to go through all the literature and put it in perspective and have people realize that most of the information that they get via the web about growth hormone, for example, about things that will make you live longer and take, you know, coconut oil and this magic pill, you know, mucoproteins or whatever's the hottest fad to sell you a product. Most of the stuff is based on exaggerations and fraud. I mean, look at trying to sell people some concepts. You know, the idea that you can take this amino acid or arginine and it'll raise growth hormone and make you live longer, and that's completely untrue, and it's all over the Internet to sell people product. And you're right, people are left not knowing who to believe or what to believe, and if they believe everything they read, they'd be taking, you know, $4,000 worth of supplements a month, and then, you know, and eating every unhealthy, and eating everything in the book or being afraid of everything in the book. So I really think that you're right. I mean, on the other hand, I mean, the biggest thing that's the fraud that's being perpetrated on our population today is the high-protein Atkins diet in South Beach, which is the most dangerous thing a person could possibly do for their health and longevity, and people have been taken... You know, there's been so much fraudulent information, and people actually believe it after a while because the publicity from the media is so big. I mean, that's really sad because obviously people drop dead of a heart attack, and there are people dying of heart attacks obviously every 30 seconds. But so many people have actually died of heart disease or died of cardiac arrhythmias following these dangerous high protein diets that it really, you know, we've got to do something to get some information out to people that they know not that they don't have to commit suicide to lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the high protein, I know a lot of people who drink a lot of fortified soy milk and eat a lot of the soy meats, the hot dogs and the chicken list burgers. Are they in danger of, say, I read one study that a large amount of soy will increase your estrogen levels. Are they in danger of that or anything else?
Well, don't forget, it depends on their age. I mean, obviously, if you eat a lot of soy, it doesn't increase your estrogen levels, but it binds to estrogen receptors. Those phytoestrogens resemble the chemical shape of estrogen compounds. And the body, in certain degrees, the body can sense more estrogens coming in. And giving, let's say, an overabundance of soy, for example, to infants and children, if their diet, you know, their diet is they're raised on soy formula, and then they have soy, you know, soy-based diet as they're growing up, it could have some effect when they're in the growth stages at with certain potential problems with that. But again, that's really coming from a diet that's almost totally soy-based and not well-rounded. For an adult who's having, you know, I don't think those, you know, fake chickens and the cheeses and the chicken burgers and the soy-based turkeys, and I don't think those are healthy foods. They're overly processed. They don't contain the fatty acids and fibers and all the healthy phytochemicals that are present in natural soy, and these products are very high in salt. And salt is particularly dangerous to a vegan or a vegetarian, more so than to a person not on a vegetarian diet. Are you aware of that?
No. Why is that?
Well, because there are two types of strokes. There's embolic strokes and there's hemorrhagic strokes. In an embolic stroke, you're getting a clot that goes to the brain. That's caused by eating a diet rich in saturated fat and animal products like cheese and meat.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing that causes a heart attack. But as people lower their cholesterol and eat a diet lower in saturated fat and cholesterol and animal products to protect their heart, if they're eating a lot of salt in their diet, they're at higher risk of hemorrhagic stroke. That's a type only one-tenth of all strokes are hemorrhagic. That's where a fragile blood vessel in the brain can break, and you can have a devastating stroke. And so those strokes are related to salt eating, and they're inversely related to cholesterol, meaning as lower cholesterols have people have a higher risk of hemorrhagic stroke, and people on vegetarian diets, like, for example, in the Orient, in Japan for years and years, they had much higher risk of hemorrhagic strokes but much lower risk of heart attacks because their diet wasn't so heart attack promoting, but they were consuming lots of salt. The bottom line is that the atherosclerotic process that kind of like coats the vessels with a dangerous lining promoting a risk of embolism and heart attack actually has some protective effect on the fragile blood vessels in the brain that are prone to rupture under years of pressure from high blood pressure from a high salt diet. I know that's a big handful, too, that I just said, but I mean, are you following what I'm saying?
Yes, I am, and it's really great information. I know a lot of, or I converse with a lot of weightlifters who are vegan who really promote the vegan meat products because it gives them a high protein input. Because, you know, their input has to equal the output and all that. What would you say to those types of people? What would your advice be?
Well, don't forget, obviously growth is not the maximum criteria for long life. And I consider adding the high-protein processed foods, I mean, for each calorie of that you're adding, you're putting a processed food in your diet that doesn't contain the full symphony of nutrients present in a natural food like fruits or vegetables or nuts or seeds or avocados. So you're actually lowering the nutrient content of your diet. And the nutrient content should be proportional or commensurate with your overall caloric intake. So it's not a healthy thing to be living on processed foods. Even if your processed foods are soy shakes and they're not full of saturated fat, it's still not an ideal thing to do. Those things can be eaten in small amounts as an addition to your diet, but you still got to, you know, I advise a lot of world-class and professional athletes on maximizing their nutrition. You know, but these people who are basketball players and tennis players and skiers. We want good muscular structure. We're not trying to necessarily promote, you know, the biggest bodybuilder in the world because that's always not the, you know, it's hard to eat a healthy diet and get maximally big for competition. So sometimes being, you know, maximal size cannot be the criteria for maximal health. You follow that?
Right, yeah.
You know, because obviously we look at linebackers on a football team. They die. They have a heart attack risk four times greater than the tight ends and running backs because, you know, eating to get big and getting big increases your BMI and extra built-up muscle on your tissue is not conducive to a longer life, just like built up fat on your tissue was not.
I'm anticipating some people listening who are not not familiar with a lot of these foods that you're tossing around, you know, the avocados and the nuts and the lentils and everything, and thinking already that a diet that's primarily plant-based is just too difficult, and then thinking, well, okay, so now I've just heard on the radio that, you know, I can't really just go and replace my comfort foods with just a soy alternative that's necessarily going to be healthy for me either. Gosh, this sounds complicated. I might as well just stick with my original, you know, diet of like the lean chicken breast and my soy or in my fish fillet. Can you clarify whether or not, you know, it is easy? How do you get, you know, how do you encourage people, or do you still encourage people to transition if they're just feeling like it's too much effort to eat these foods? Like for me, for when you say avocados, lentils, you know, kidney beans, I'm thinking yum, but there was definitely a point in my life when I would have thought, bleh, that sounds kind of boring and gross. Can you just tell us more about
the diet?
But
you know what, we started this show and we kind of like, we did it the reversed order. We start talking about soy and asking questions about nutrition.
Right.
Whereas if we got the little basis of nutrition from my book, Eat to Live, and then segued into soy and these other issues, it'd be so much easier to understand, because obviously my point is, and of course that's what I do in the book, Eat to Live, is I tell people that losing weight is not the only goal. We want to have great health simultaneously. And the diet that's the healthiest for us will have us radically and safely lose weight at the same time, which has to do with nutrient density. But I guess the answer to your question is that the question is, can you eat a diet style that can totally preclude the possibility of having a heart attack? Can we radically prevent cancer? Can we live off 30 years longer, maintain our mental faculties, our physical vigor, our youthful vitality as we get older, maintain an ideal weight? And I have to make each person a nutritional expert, get them so motivated and psyched up as to feeling that there's no chance they can, something go wrong with their body. They can't have a heart attack. And wouldn't you want that? You want to be in an ICU room with tubes down your throat, you know, dropping dead? I mean, to me, you know, good nutrition is worth it, and you got to know what good nutrition is. And then the second question is, can this diet style taste great? Can we make it so it fits into your life, so it's not overwhelming with shopping and cooking every single meal? Can you make it taste better or just as good as the diet you're eating now? And if so, and if I can prove to you that it can taste phenomenally great, you'll like it better than your old diet, and guarantee you such great health in the process, wouldn't you be an idiot not to eat healthier? You know, so the answer to your question is, yeah, you can take the health, we have the greatest chefs in the world, can take the healthiest foods on the planet and make it taste, knock your socks off. I have great salad dressings and, you know, great ways to soups, and, you know, I love to eat lots of, the reason I do, I'm not overweight, but I love to eat lots of great tasting food, I'm sure you do too, and not have to worry about your weight or how much you're eating. And that's the key and the basis between my book, Eat to Live, and I guess the basis of the question you're asking, which, you know, how do you get people to shift it off their diet that's based on processed foods, junk food, not, you know, they're not eating natural foods, whether they're eating, you know, the average American diet, or diet in, you know, here in North America is 40% of calories from animal products and 50% from processed foods. They're only eating about 4% of calories from natural foods, and the question is, whether you eat animal products or not, you can't expect to have great health unless we change that ratio and get that 4% of calories from unrefined plant foods up to very high levels. I mean, that's the question for a vegetarian or for a non-vegetarian, because we got to even a lot of vegetarians don't eat enough fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. or nuts and seeds and beans, the healthy plant foods. And certainly, people that eat conventionally don't eat enough of those foods either. So they're really, you know, obviously we're in a very sickly society. Most people are eating themselves to death, and that's why we have, you know, 40% of our population dying of heart attacks, 12% dying of strokes, and 35% dying of cancer. These are diseases of nutritional stupidity.
Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that we do talk more about your nutritional advice, and I agree that we've kind of done things a bit in reverse. But I wanted to, before we just take a short break, just jump back to soy for a second.
Sure.
Because we had talked a little bit about the phytoestrogens, and one of my friends who is vegan, he often hears people say, but if you're eating soy, you're going to become effeminate. And I think that... I think that vegetarianism is already associated to some degree with being feminine somehow. There's a connection there. And then this scares people even more. He has, you know, guys coming up to him saying, you know, but it's going to make you effeminate. Can you just talk a little bit more about the phytoestrogens and what that means, again, for people? This is a concern that is, like, out there in the world right now.
Well, that's not a realistic, you know, concern. That's just silliness. I mean, you can't change a person. You're not going to make a person... their sexual orientation because they ate soy or didn't eat soy, or whether they, that's just silly. I mean, a person doesn't become more manly or masculine because they eat, you know, because they eat lentils or eat soy or eat, you know, meat or eat, you know, more red meat is going to give you, that's just untrue. I think what that's stemming from is that the phytoestrogens, there is some literature to support that in the first 2 years of life, there are some babies that are susceptible to eating so much soy in the first 2 years of life, and some males can have decreased size of their testicles being raised on soy, but that's only in the first 2 years of life. You're not going to change your sexual orientation, or your sexual hormonal levels from eating soy once these levels are set from your childhood intake. Obviously, we know, for example, that how we eat as a child has far-reaching effects on our, but also the parents that were raised within the environment were raised, and all these things have effects on us. Not whether we eat soy as an adult or not really has no effect. But the answer to your question is that the phytoestrogens in soy, like every other food, can only have a negative effect if we're eating a diet that's containing a predominance or a excessive amount of soy foods in the diet. Those will have a negligible or no effect at all if the diet has soy in it. But if you're having a diet that's 80% soy, which some, you know, young children may, that could be a negative factor. We should not be eating a diet that's made of all soy. Does that help answer your question?
No, it certainly does. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk more about the book. I want to hear your thoughts on what you mean exactly by nutrient-dense foods and variety, and some suggestions for people about how they could incorporate these foods into their diet, and more about how to make them taste great. We'll just take a short break, and then we'll come back with Dr. Joel Furman. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host Lauren Corman. I forgot to mention Lamia. She's our tech. She's back from a couple of weeks hiatus, and so we're glad to have her back today. If you have any questions or comments for Animal Voices, do write us at animalvoices@ciut.fm. And we're here with Dr. Joel Furman, and he is talking with us about soy, and now we're going to switch the conversation over to his new book, Eat to Live. But before we do that, Rob had an interesting question about soy milk and dairy cow milk.
Are you there, Dr. Furman?
Yes, I can hear you well.
Great. I just wanted to say, I know a lot of people are hearing, you know, soy is bad, and in the first 2 years, don't feed your child soy. But some people might be hearing that, oh, it's great, then I'll feed my child cow's milk, just as I always have been. Is there a danger for cow's milk as well in young children, and if you have a predominance of cow's milk in your daily diet?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you guys, I mean, everybody should know that young humans are designed to be raised on breast milk.
And we know that, but a lot of our listeners don't, so go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's such a beautiful, you know, it's such a fascinating thing where the digestive tract, which is holy, like porous, like cheesecloth, and it's made that way intentionally because the immune system isn't developed at birth. It takes, you know, years, even up to 2 years for the immune system to fully develop. And while the immune system is still not developed, the porousness of the digestive tract allows the immunoglobulins of the mother's breast milk to come right through those holes and supplement the infant's immune system. And then over the two-year period, those holes those tight junction between the cells close up, and the immunoglobulins don't get absorbed or utilized by the baby anymore because their own immune system is working very well. Mm-hmm. The point is that children who are breastfed are more intelligent. They have lower rates of allergies and asthma. They don't have Crohn's disease. In other words, if you feed your children on cow's milk in the first 2 years of life or cow's milk formula, you're putting them at substantial risk of danger, including very serious illnesses later on in life, like Crohn's disease and colitis, and rheumatoid arthritis or psoriatic arthritis, asthma and allergies. I mean, some potentially, you know, lupus, life-threatening conditions increase. It's not a safe thing to do. Raising them the first 2 years on soy milk instead of breast milk comes out with some other type problems. But the point is that you can't expect for your child to be at optimal health unless they're raised on breast milk, because that's the food that nature or God made for humans.
Great. I'm so glad that you mentioned that.
Okay. I wanted to make sure we give you a chance to talk about your book. We've had nutritionists on Animal Voices before that have talked to us about their various different nutritional advice. And we've had people on, too, that would be considered by most standards overweight in our society or fat, who eat a very balanced whole foods diet and also get lots of exercise. So we haven't really talked very much about weight loss. And I wanted to focus on nutrition and what you meant by nutrient-dense foods and variety. Can you tell us more about your perspective on nutrition?
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly Eat to Live is a great book for people wanting to learn more about how to eat healthier for a longer life. But its primarily goal is for people who are overweight. They can lose weight in the healthiest manner possible and learn that it's safe to lose weight relatively. You know, if I have 100 pounds to lose or 50 pounds to lose, you don't have to take 4 years to lose it. The weight drops off you relatively quickly. My average patient loses about 15 pounds the first month and about 10 pounds each month thereafter, and then it slows down as they start approaching their ideal weight. The point is that diets don't work. People lose and gain and lose and gain only by educating people as to, you know, going for optimal health and how to make, you know, they see this as a lifetime commitment and a change for life, and they're eating the same diet I'm eating, and they make it taste great, and they can really learn to love it. Can they, life for a lifetime, keep their weight and gravitate it? Have it gravitate towards a healthy weight and keep it for life. But what it recognizes is the addictive nature of food. And what makes Eat to Live somewhat unique is it teaches people that nutrient density is related to hunger and what I call toxic hunger, which makes you want to eat all the time when you're not really hungry. Because when you haven't met your nutrient requirements, the brain is, you know, has perverted cravings. And it also explains that when you're kind of like withdrawing from your rich or toxic diet and you feel shaky and headachy and weak and your stomach's cramping and you feel your stomach spasming, that those symptoms go away when people eat a high-nutrient diet. They get back in touch with what I call true hunger again. And true hunger directs them to the amount of calories they really need and only the calories they need to maintain a lean, you know, muscular, lean, ideal weight. So it's kind of complicated. It has to do with nutrient density. Of course, it has to do with eating natural foods. And it teaches that if you do eat the nutrient density, you know, if we eat what I call my unlimited foods, eat large amounts of green vegetables and beans and eggplants and mushrooms and tomatoes and, you know, cauliflower and peppers and, you know, fresh fruits. And as you get these, as we make the, you know, these recipes with high levels and big portion sizes, not small portions, because people got to rethink the size portions they're eating. As they eat large portions of these unlimited foods, it takes away their cravings for eating junk. They don't want to eat as much pasta. They're not hungry for the oil. They're not hungry for the rich, for the animal products, the cheeses. They're not want to put a cookie or a cracker in their mouth 2 hours after they eat. In other words, it takes away their desire to constantly put food in their mouth when they fill up their nutritional reservoirs. So I guess that's some of the basis of the Eat to Live program.
I think a lot of people associate a diet like that with being expensive. Can you talk to us about whether or not it's expensive?
Sure. I mean, certainly you can make it, you know, if you're eating a lot of foods that are very expensive, like organic berries and figs, I mean, you can make a diet expensive, and my diet's fairly expensive, but you can make it relatively, you know, cheaper too by eating more things like, you know, by eating more dried beans and making more soups and certainly eating vegetables and fruits that aren't the quite exotic, more expensive fruits. So, I mean, you could do that with any type of diet, but I mean, it's also, you know, but I don't know about you guys, but for me, I think that your health is your greatest wealth, and that it's kind of expensive for me to be in a ICU with a tube in my throat or in my groin after a heart attack or a stroke. And I think our happiness in life is really hinged on our health protection. I mean, I'm about 50 years old, and I, you know, may play tennis for 2 hours, you know, I could maintain my youthful athletic ability, enjoy my life to the fullest extent possible, have zero possibility of having a heart attack or a stroke. I mean, I have 400 physicians live in this half-mile square radius here where I live in New Jersey, and we have a population that literally is committing suicide with food, yet they would, you know, but eating healthy, you know, I don't consider eating healthy expensive. I mean, first of all, it costs about the same anyway, but, I mean, you could make it more expensive or less expensive, but the bottom line is that what good is your money if you're going to be in a coffin, or what good is money if you're going to be in a nursing home after a stroke, or what good? In other words, you have to in life put money away for your future. That's a great idea, but putting your health, but what you eat now is protecting your future. The best way you can protect yourself for your retirement or later years in your life is take better care of your health when you're young, because you become eventually what you ate when you were young in life. Mm-hmm. Whether you have, you know, when your bones deteriorate, or whether you have arthritic hip, or whether you have, whether you develop high blood pressure or high cholesterol, or whether you have a heart attack or a stroke, or whether you get breast cancer or colon cancer, it doesn't happen from what you did a year or two before the cancer emerges. That's what from what you did 20 or 30 years back. I mean, now is when wherever you are in life, you have to start putting money in the bank as far as your health is concerned, with taking good care of yourself, because then your body will be there to protect you as you get older. And that's what, you know, my niche in the healthcare field. And at drfurman.com or in my book, Eat to Live, I motivate people and teach people how they can protect themselves and protect their futures by taking better care of their health right now. And people, because they're addicted to food, I mean, they'll look for excuses. It's too hard, I'm too busy, it costs too much, it's easier, you know, it's more convenient, I don't like that way of eating, I can't be a vegetarian, I like eating meat this too much, I'm not going to change. You know, people will give all kind of excuses. But if you can get them to really see the value and have them really say that you don't have to give up all the things you're eating right now, but if you make some aggressive or if you make some significant changes, you're going to see some significant results. That the changes are going to be worth it. And eventually, as you get better at this, you're going to find that you like this way of eating just as much or even better than your old way of eating. And those excuses kind of melt away.
Why do we want to eat foods that are not good for us?
Well, that's a good question. Well, you know, think about this. If you're eating 10 cups of coffee a day and you stop drinking coffee, you feel crappy, right? That's called withdrawal or detoxification. And people, you can make this person feel better by giving them more caffeine or maybe more coffee, but that's not going to get them well. That's not really getting them well. The same thing is true with food. Their diet is, you know, rich. It's much too much salt. It's much too much saturated fat. They're not getting the nutrients they need. And like withdrawing from coffee, they withdraw a few hours, just 3 or 4 hours after they eat, they start going through detoxification symptoms from their toxic diet. And they feel better when they eat again. So they're addicted to eating, and they're addicted to eating unhealthy food, because a healthy food doesn't make them feel better. And as you eat foods that are higher in fat and higher in salt and higher in, you know, sugar, as you eat foods that are more concentrated, it deadens your taste buds. So now the subtle flavors in natural foods, you don't enjoy as much. You can't just enjoy a pear or an avocado or a cashew nut. It doesn't taste that flavorful. They can say, well, it tastes like wood. There's no flavor to that. In other words, because their diet is so overly stimulating, they've lost their ability to get enough pleasure from the subtle flavors that are more natural foods. So it's a, you know, it's a complicated question. But obviously, we live in a toxic food environment. We have the most obese population in the history of the human race. And my message to people is that they can lose 50 to 100 pounds. They don't have to go through gastric bypass surgery. If they learn this information, they can recover their health. If you have asthma, if you have colitis, if you have heart disease, high blood pressure, cholesterol. Like, for example, in the medical journal Metabolism, this vegetable-based approach was shown to lower cholesterol more radically or more aggressively than cholesterol-lowering drugs. That you can get your blood pressure normalized, your cholesterol normalized without drugs. You know, how many people out there think that their only choice is to take medications for the rest of their life? They weren't given the option. For those people who want to make this type of, you know, you could say, you know, this large type of aggressive changes to maximize their health, that they weren't informed they could get well without taking drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And my message is they can lose weight effectively, they can get back their health, and that's why, obviously, I wrote the book Eat to Live, because it's not made to be the best-selling book for the masses. It's made for those, it occupies that niche, for those people to know what they would want to do what was best or ideal to recover their health again.
Dr. Furman, thanks for being on the program. We're totally out of time. If people have questions, I can certainly forward them to you, but also check out drfurman.com, and the book is Eat to Live, and you've been listening to Animal Voices at CIUT 89.5. Thanks again, Joel, for being on.
Oh, sure. My pleasure. And just to mention, it's drfurman.com for people who know how to spell my name.
Great. Thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.